Welcome to this archive edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Today we're going to listen to a conversation I had last spring with Dr. Martha Jones about her latest book, The Trouble of Color, an American Family Memoir. Dr. Jones is a former lawyer, a celebrated historian, and the author of several award-winning books. This book is unlike any of her others, in that although it's a work of history, it is a deeply personal history of Dr. Jones' own family and an exploration of the shifting, difficult, and thorny parameters of race and identity. Dr. Jones reminds us that in his landmark book, The Souls of Black Folk, W.E.B. Du Bois writes, quote, "The problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line." In The Trouble of Color, Jones writes, "I was learning that this boundary, one said to divide black from white, was neither solid nor sure. It was instead jagged, sharp-edged, and threatening." The Trouble of Color is a beautifully crafted rumination on that jagged and threatening line and a timely peroration on race at a moment in our country's history when diversity and equity are under attack from officials in the highest levels of our government. Dr. Martha S. Jones, join me in Studio A. It's good to have you back on the show.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
So this book kind of sprang from an experience you had as a freshman in college a while back. You're up at SUNY New Paltz, and a classmate made a comment. Tell us about that experience back in the day.
My friend Ron, who became my friend, but only after, as you suggest, we had a rather pointed encounter. It was 1976. I've now dated myself for anybody who was wondering. And we were students in a new field, an emerging field called Black Studies, a Black Sociology course. And I was, as you said, a first semester student. And I was pretty green, as we say. And at the same time, I was game. And so I'm making a presentation to the class on what is now a classic text, Franz Fanon's A Dying Colonialism. And midway through the presentation, Ron stands up and basically rebukes me and challenges me not only on what I might not know about Fanon and his book, but really about who I am. Do I really belong in this classroom? And I realize he's not just hearing my words. He's looking at me and unsure, or maybe quite sure, that someone with my complexion and my hair texture and probably a very suburban accent in those years, that I maybe was someone who didn't belong in Black Studies.
And that shocked you.
It did. You know, I was no stranger to being asked, you know, what are you? I had grown up in a multi-ethnic enclave in suburban New York where, you know, are you Italian? Are you Polish? Are you Black? Are you Catholic? I knew that question, but I think naively, I believed that I had come to college and adulthood. By that, I mean the kind of teasing that had gone on in my schoolgirl days, I thought were behind me. And it was, in a sense, because I think Ron's question was far more serious and one that I encountered and have encountered many, many times over since that fall of 1976.
So I may have misspoke when I introduced you and this book, which I really enjoyed, and it's beautifully written on top of it being an interesting story of your family, because I called it a work of history. Mm. And at the end of the book, you say it's, after all, a work of literature rather than of history. Now, you are an historian. You've written works of history. You know your way around works of history. So when you say it's literature, because it is deeply personal, this is about you and your encounters with race and identity, a work of literature. Interesting.
Well, the first thing that I mean by that is that I think in this book, like no other I'd written, I aspired at least, to be a writer. And this is a book without footnotes. And so part of what I was aiming to learn for the first time in my writing career was how to persuade a writer on the very page. In other words, there's no flipping to the back to see what my sources are. There's no, you know, buttressing my assertions. I have to, from the beginning, earn a reader's trust and confidence so that they will come on this journey with me. And it is a meandering, many generations long journey. And that, to me, is a literary challenge that is distinct from the way in which I persuade readers when I am writing a more conventional history, where, be sure, there are plenty of footnotes.
Yeah, and there's a bibliography in this mm-hmm. book. But what's also fascinating, you write in your the bio that appears for you on the Johns Hopkins website that you're in your happy place when you're in the archives. And I was taken by that because in this book, you go to the archives, you find out all sorts of information that you nor anybody else in your family knew before, but then you have to encounter it in a very personal way. It's vulnerable, it's emotional, it's difficult. So that's a different endeavor than a work of history. We talked the last time you were here about a book you wrote called Vanguard, which is about voting rights and black women and their involvement in the voting, the suffragist movement, etc. But this is a very different interpretation of that stuff you dug up from the archives.
Yeah, I also, in this book, very intentionally made myself a character. And I did so in part because I had tried on and off for many years, truthfully, to write about my family's history as history. And nearly every time I did it, it fell flat. It just didn't go anywhere. But the urge or the drive to write it didn't go away. But what I had to do was understand that I was going to be a character, and not only in terms of the who, the what, the where, what I did, but I was going to have to allow readers to peer into how I felt. And that is very new because, as you know, and your listeners will know, you know, historians rely, you know, to some important degree on our kind of omniscience about, at least about our subject matter and about our expertise and about being authorities. And we oftentimes are. But in this book, I never felt like an expert or an authority. I stayed very close, as I think I needed to who I am as a descendant, as a member of a family, as someone, as you say, discovering things for the very first time and bringing readers in on that.
Dr. Martha S. Jones, the book is called The Trouble of Color, an American Family Memoir. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. So you had to do a little speculation in this because you would find information and then you would have to imagine that person, a great-grandfather, a great-great-grandfather, a great-great-great-grandmother. You went back five generations in this. Going back to this quote that I referred to when I introduced you by W.E.B. Du Bois about the color line, you write that this boundary that was supposed to divide black and white, it's not solid, it's not sure. You say it's jagged, sharp-edged, and threatening. Expand about that.
Sure. I go back five generations, as you say, and what that means in my family's story is that I am now going to take readers into the world of slavery in North Carolina and in Kentucky, where my people are from. I'm going to introduce you to women whose lives are indelibly marred by sexual violence. Some of the evidence of that is their own children. Some of that evidence is their own skin. But this is the beginning of a story in which I look to show us the ways in which not only did people cross the color line in many kinds of ways throughout the book, but that this is the story, rather than the one that came to us by lawmakers or came to us by, you know, pseudo-sociologists or race scientists who tried to pitch us, right, a vision of a world in which we were all divided from one another. I'm a child of the 1950s. My parents married across the color line, as we say. And for a long time, I had been led to think that they were the first, you know, that they had done something profoundly taboo and still illegal in many, many states, including my father's home state of North Carolina. And it wasn't until I really dove into the material for this book, but sat with the stories in this book, that I realized that my parents were hardly the first. But the stories that we told about it posited it as such.
Sure. I mean, you know, we hear about Loving v. Virginia and, you know, some famous court cases. And there are, and we should be clear for folks, your father's race on his birth certificate says white. That's a whole other story.
Yeah. Well, I say his death certificate, and we can talk about that. So he's born in 1926, Atlanta, Georgia, and he's colored. He is buried, though, you are right, marked as white.
Yeah. And your mom is white, by whatever definition. I mean, this whole...
The child
this whole...
of German and Irish yeah. immigrants.
Yeah. Because you write about the attempts, some of them legal, some of them legislative, to define this color line that Du Bois talks about. In 1866, they tried to pass a law that says, you know, here's who's colored, here's who's not. Negroes and their issue, even when one ancestor in each succeeding generation to the fourth inclusive is white, shall be deemed persons of color. And you talk about how that statute is formulated, the sort of quasi-legalese that they use. I mean, there have been attempts all over the place to say, okay, well, we have this figured out.
Yeah, I mean, and we live with that until today. As we, I don't know, some of us have memories of a 2010 census. Others of us can anticipate 2030 coming up. Each 10 years in the ordinary course of American life, we confront the shifting thinking, because no two censuses have ever been the same, used the same terminology, relied on the same categories. And so in a sense, we all know some version of these shifting terms. But of course, you're pointing out that in 19th century America and well into 20th century America, there is a special concern on the part of lawmakers about marriage, about family making. And it turns out in my family, there were people defying those rules going all the way back to the beginning of the 19th century.
And the tension between the people in your family who passed as white and the others who did not, mm-hmm. And the tension, intergenerational tension, sibling tension, you know, you explicate and talk about so movingly. But you mentioned the terminology, the rhetoric around mixed race is fascinating and can be incredibly harmful. Mixed, mulatto, you call them migrants along the color line. Mm-hmm. Mulatto, quadroon, hybrid, and even at some point there were lawmakers who said that these people of whatever they were going to be called were a distinct class of people, entitled to certain things and unentitled to other things. That has really shaped the racial dynamic in a way that's often not talked about.
One of the things that I learned in doing this book was about a pernicious theory that had its origins in the 19th century but persisted into the 20th, that was called mulatto degeneracy. A theory promoted by pseudo-scientists of race, promoted by lawmakers, promoted by the U.S. Census, the view that people of so-called, what we would say today, mixed race people were biologically inferior, prone to die earlier, prone to be sterile, unable to have children. And in the U.S., we spend generations, not we, me, but collectively as a nation, we spend a great deal of energy exploring and looking to substantiate, or in my story, by the 1920s, black anthropologists who are looking to discredit this theory. But it has a long life, and probably a life that persists even after it is discredited in scientific circles.
And it permeates all sorts of areas of American legal life and legislative life and social life. You mentioned that there were Native American families who were encouraged to have the state for the census record them as people of color or mulatto so they could avoid being expulsed, expulsion from North Carolina. And so, you know, crossing over all sorts of interesting boundaries.
And here, I think, you know, like anyone who's done family history research in the U.S. has encountered the U.S. Census, its columns and its categories and the tick marks and abbreviations marked by some man, actually, whose name is actually at the top of the sheet if you read, you know, the fine print. But I came to see those things less as the facts, which is often how we use the census when we do family history research, and really to see things like census returns and wills and death certificates as stories. Right? A census taker has a limited set of variables or parameters through which he can tell the story of a given household, a given family. And indeed, as you describe, Native people in central North Carolina, in this little Texas today, the people of the Okanichi-Saponi Nation are remembered for having tricked the eyes of the census enumerator to protect their families and to protect their community in a period of extraordinary risk and official assault. So census takers are important in this story, but they don't enjoy pride of place when it comes to understanding who people were and how they understood themselves. And that tension is part of what's interesting to me in the book, is the way in which we negotiate, even with a court clerk who's there to give you your marriage license. You're not going to tell him the whole story. You're going to try and tell the story he needs you to tell so that you can go home with what you came for. And that's very different than reading the document itself as some kind of gospel.
Dr. Martha S. Jones, her new book is called The Trouble of Color, an American Family Memoir. We'll have more with Dr. Jones on the other side of a quick break. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back to this archive edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're listening today to a conversation I had with an acclaimed public historian on the faculty of Johns Hopkins University. Martha S. Jones is the Society of Black Alumni Presidential Professor, Professor of History, Professor at the SNF Agora Institute, and Director of Graduate Studies at Johns Hopkins. She's written several books, and she's published articles in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Atlantic, and other major circulation papers and magazines. We talked about her latest book, a personal memoir and a work of compelling history. It's called The Trouble with Color, an American Family Memoir. We spoke last March because our show was pre-recorded. We aren't able to take any calls or online comments today. Here's more of my conversation with Dr. Martha S. Jones.
I want to talk a little bit about a character named Grandy, your grandfather, who was at one time the president of Bennett College, an all-women's HBCU. It's in Greensboro, North Carolina. His father had been a free man of color, right, who lived nearby. And you're in the Danville Public Library, and you're searching for information about the family. I mentioned that, you know, your happy place is in the archives, but there are all sorts of challenges for families of color trying to look back and find information about their enslaved relatives. How did you overcome those challenges, and what's your advice to those families who would like to know more?
I guess there are two ways to answer that. One is I'm someone who I think a characteristic I share, I think, with many family historians is a kind of unparalleled doggedness about, you know, what it is I think I'm looking for. So who else would stay up until 3 o'clock in the morning meticulously going through the Greensboro, North Carolina censuses until she finds the people she's looking for, the story she's looking for? So I think there is that kind of, if that's wisdom, right, that our passion, our drive is really one of our great distinguishing assets. And I certainly exercise that to the nth degree in this story. But the other thing, and you mentioned my grandfather, Grandy, and his father, Dallas Jones. Dallas Jones was, as you said, a free man of color in central North Carolina. He settles in Greensboro in a black enclave. He becomes many things, a shoemaker, a barkeep, and more. But his real passion is politics, and he's a radical Republican activist. On through the years in which in North Carolina white supremacy resurges and Republicans, particularly black Republicans, are at tremendous risk. I'm able to follow Dallas's story all the way through a remarkable broadside that's published in the early 1890s in Greensboro in anticipation of Election Day. It lists the name of every black male voter in the county and puts them and white Democrats on notice that these men should be stopped at the polls. And that's where, for me, Dallas's story ends. Now, I'm a dogged researcher, which is to say, I'd like to think I turned over every stone. I'd love to hear from anybody who has suggestions about where else I might look. But I had to sit myself and then ask my readers to sit with me at the end of a life story that has no end, as we conventionally know it. Did he disappear using his light skin to somehow blend into some other community and live his life anonymously or under another kind of identity? In the latter years, was he run out of town? Was he murdered? This is the era of racial violence.
They
lynching.
Published the names, yeah.
Absolutely, and so, and all I can say to a reader is, I don't know. I can tell you how I feel about that, but to your point, you know, part of what I had to tell the reader is not only is the official record, the newspapers or the death certificates, not only are those things silent, my family story is absolutely silent. And people tell many stories, and I've collected a great number of them from within the family. No one has ever spoken who knew Dallas or knew of Dallas. And I have to ask readers to, in a sense, endure, right, that story that doesn't have an end. But isn't that part of the story, too, sometimes? What we can't know turns out to be, in its own way, illuminating about the world in which Dallas lived.
And you mentioned the possibility that being light-skinned, perhaps he was able to, you know, establish himself somewhere else with a new identity. And I want to talk a little more about your personal experience with this notion of passing. You write at one point, you tell a story about a waitress in a restaurant who says, well, what race are you? You know, and you didn't pass with her. But you say it at another point in the book, talking about a relative named Fanny that we'll talk about in a second, I couldn't shake the sense that I was passing, and it was a dilemma from which I could not extricate myself. Talk about the dilemma of being able to pass and wondering whether or not you should.
Fanny's story is about movie theaters and department stores in the decades before the Second World War, how she uses her skin to trick the eye. Well, largely, I have not grown up in a world where movie theaters or department stores are formally segregated, but I certainly have lived and continue to live in a world in which I know my family and my friends with darker hues are still scrutinized and harassed and followed, and worse, in the realm of public accommodations. So who am I when I walk to a ticket counter or I step up to a department store counter? Is the courtesy that I am extended a broad courtesy extended to all patrons? Or is the courtesy that is extended to me linked somehow to a perception or a misperception of my color? I'd be interested to hear from people who think otherwise, but my experience is I'd never live a life if I spent most of it announcing who I am or explaining who I am at every turn. I frankly don't think everyone whom I encounter, you know, in the post office is especially entitled to a confession from me about who I think I am and how that works and where I come from. So I think it is a dilemma, right, from which I cannot extricate myself. So can I tell you a funny story?
Please.
So I was in Montgomery, Alabama over the weekend to talk with folks there about this book, and I was in line at Panny George's, which is a soul food restaurant in the Legacy Museum there. And there were two young women behind us, and they say to me, can we ask you a question about your skin? And I, inside, I freeze up because I'm thinking, now what is coming? One of them appears to be a young African-American woman. The other appears to be a young white woman. And I think, here we go again, is what I think. Well, it turns out that who I am today is a woman of a certain age whose skin looks pretty good.
It does.
So, so what they want to know is not about my race at all. They want to know
skincare regimen.
My skin. They want to know about my retinol and my sunscreen. And and it's one of the things that this book has taught me, right, is to laugh and to laugh at myself in those moments. Because how could I explain to them what I thought was about to happen and how uncomfortable it made me when they are just as sweet and generous to me as an older woman and complimenting my skin? You know, it's a dilemma and it doesn't go away. Maybe personally writing this book has meant that I have a sense of humor about it and I can see humor in some of those moments where I was much more inclined toward pathos for much of my life. But it doesn't promise to end, at least not in my lifetime.
Martha S. Jones, the book is The Trouble of Color, an American Family Memoir. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Let's go to the phones. Brooke is on the line in Ellicott City. Welcome to the show. Thanks for checking in.
Hi. Thank you, Tom. And you too as well, Ms. Jones. I am also trying to conduct research on my family history. I'm a black woman from Maryland. I grew up in Baltimore and Columbia. And I was, one of the things, I got into a conversation with a friend who referred to herself as mixed race. And I remember saying, wow, you know, if you're black and in America, you're probably mixed race, and, except for the difference being that you know your white lineage if you are, if you consider yourself mixed race. And so I had gone on sort of a journey to find my white ancestry and turned up fairly unsuccessful, except for that I found one white ancestor who actually turned out to be Aaron Burr. And it's been really interesting because I later discovered that all of Aaron Burr's descendants are people of color that are living. And it has actually created quite a stir with the Aaron Burr Association. But just not even being able to find any other ancestry of European descent when my ancestry DNA says that I'm 30% European, right? So I'm just sort of fascinated in terms of how does one go about sort of doing that digging into their family history.
Well, thanks so much for that call, Brooke. That's terrific.
Yeah, thank you so much, and thanks for sharing the story. One of the first things that occurs to me is a bit of what we were saying earlier, which is that it's true that a great deal of the official record was not written with our questions in mind. And in fact, it's much of it is constructed to hide the very kinds of questions that you're asking, Brooke, and the kind of questions that I'm asking. I met librarians who very nicely said to me, you know, go away. This is too disturbing. And so I think that I really appreciate the experience that you're having and the reluctance of people to hear the stories you want to tell. You know, one of the things that I did, and perhaps you have too, right, is to go back and collect those family stories and to take them seriously. I also had a great grandmother who for a long time explained that she was related to, she was the granddaughter, in fact, of John Jacob Astor, the 19th century wealthy New Yorker. And for a long time, I didn't take that seriously at all. But when I did, I found, you have to read the book to see if I persuade you, but I found enough there. And it meant reading the narratives of enslaved people from that region of the country. She was from Eastern North Carolina. It meant reading newspaper accounts and the details of the movements of that family to see if pieces lined up. It meant getting lucky. There was a narrative written by a man named John Jacobs that gave me a key piece of the puzzle. I'm not sure, Brooke, if I've actually connected all the dots. And I think that is part of our challenge, is to honor the stories, even when we're not able to connect all the dots and tell them anyway. Or at least that's the way I've come to approach it.
You talk about the part of the family referred to themselves as Astor's bastards.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll talk a little bit about that on the other side of a break. Dr. Martha Jones is my guest. Her book is called The Trouble of Color, an American Family Memoir. And we will continue after a few words. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us today for this archive edition of our program, my guest is Dr. Martha S. Jones, the Society of Black Alumni Presidential Professor and Professor of History at the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University. Her books on voting rights and birthright citizenship won several awards. Her latest book is a very personal work of history, a memoir of her family called The Trouble of Color. As a college student in the mid-1970s, a confrontation with a fellow student in a black studies class launched a decades-long rumination on her racial identity and that of her relatives going back five generations.
Our show was pre-recorded, so we aren't able to take any new calls or online comments today.
So again, this, I don't know what we call it, but this label, Aster Bastards, which we were talking about right before the break, but you say, here's more than a century before, an enslaved woman had briefly crossed paths with a rich and powerful man, and the result was the birth of a girl named Isabella. Isabella had Jenny. Jenny had Grandy, and Grandy, along with Musy, had my father. It was the closest he ever came to explaining why we look the way we did. And that's the nut of it, isn't it? You know, it's an explanation for how this all has come down and happened.
Well, I think that we've touched on the theme of silence, but for me, there is another, not only the silence of the historical record, but the silence even in our own families about who we are and how we came to be what we are and what it means. And I grew up in a household in which, on the one hand, you know, my parents were of the civil rights generation and embraced, I think, some of the best ideals, not naively, but hoped and dreamed that they were raising children in a world that would be, if not colorblind, would be much less preoccupied by color going forward. And so in our house, you know, we were raised not to speak of people in colored terms, not to label people or pigeonhole people, even as we understood the differences and we understood racism, certainly. So my father didn't have an explanation or a speech or the talk, as we sometimes call it for us, about who we are and where and how we fit in to the world. But that moment when he, you know, very wryly, you know, he's very amused with this notion that we're Aster bastards, and he had a great sense of humor. Well, looking back, there was a clue that I had to add to many other kinds of clues to begin to tell a story about Jenny's mother, Isabella, and who she was. And again, I think folks have to read it and see for themselves how I do on that. But the important thing for me, above all else, was to take Jenny seriously, to take her at her word, and not to, as we sometimes do, right, dismiss the stories that come to us. They seem far-fetched, they seem impractical, they seem invented in some way or another, and probably they're embellished. All good stories enjoy a good dose of embellishment. But I think in this book, my job was to listen to Jenny and then to do the work that it might take to actually put some meat on the bones of her story.
So Musy is your father's mother, so your grandmother, and you spent summers with her in Greensboro. Your family lived for a time, at least in Port Washington, Long Island, in a white cul-de-sac. You talk about how your mom and dad went off to work in their offices every day and then came home and worked in the civil rights movement. And, you know, so you were in, you were doing the coding back then, you know, to be sure. But Musy's mother was Fanny, the first college graduate in the family. And Fanny could pass, but Musy could not because of skin complexion. How did they navigate that?
Not easily, as I understand it. These stories come to me, to my father's brother, my Uncle Fuzz. And he said, Fanny was a difficult woman. I think that's a very polite way of saying that Fanny, when she went, she lived in St. Louis, Missouri, most of her adult life. When she went downtown in St. Louis, to the movie theater, to the department store, and passed as white, her daughter, her oldest, my grandmother, could not accompany her. She would have, in a sense, given Fanny away. Well, Fanny may have enjoyed, and I think she did enjoy, those outings. But my grandmother, as, at least as my Uncle Fuzz would tell it, you know, my grandmother lived with the scars of that, and that sort of graphic lived experience that marked the difference between my grandmother Muzi and her own mother Fanny. And I think that's why that's important in the story, right, is to remind us that what today we refer to as colorism also has a history and is not merely exercised by families who elevate themselves somehow by virtue of a shared color, but in fact within families, colorism is a divisive and a hurtful view of the world. I don't think Fanny was a cruel woman, but I think she was callous, as I understand it, when it came to her daughter.
Yeah, and you write that, you know, you were raised to admire and look up to Fanny. You know, she was a very accomplished person, but you say that her experience chastened you. You said you were like her, and that worries you. That is a problem. And then you refer to the wedding of your parents. They got married, and again, a mixed race marriage. There were Catholic priests who wouldn't perform that kind of wedding back in at that time. This 1957. You know, it was a hazardous situation then, and of course, it remains hazardous to this day.
Yeah, I think that's all right. You know, which is why my phrasing, the jagged color line, really runs through this book, because folks in my family are approaching the color line by all kinds of terms, right? You point to my parents' marriage. It's 1957. It's still illegal in North Carolina, my father's home state, for them to marry at all. They marry in New York City, where they met. Well, they have to contend with priests and ministers who have their own ideas and, in fact, their own precepts within the Catholic Church, for example, the attitudes about interracial marriage are shifting very importantly in the 1950s. So they've got law, they've got church, they've got family. I explained, you know, my mother's brother is the only member of her family who attends that wedding, and as she often told it, he looked like he was attending a funeral, not a wedding. So all of these are the spaces and the dynamics in which we get snagged along the color line. And they're not exactly the same. The rules may differ and the dynamics might differ. But my parents undoubtedly bore the marks of those encounters as they went on to have their own family.
I want to talk a little bit about race science. You alluded to this a while back in our conversation, and what you referred to as the double bind of class and color. You say your grandparents, for example, were exemplars of a legendary generation. They were born free. They were destined for distinction. And W.E.B. Du Bois dubbed them the talented tenth. And then there were black scholars, you know, doing work. And how did this double bind of race and class come to touch your family?
So I want to be transparent and say I was raised largely sheltered from the tension that you're describing. And it's only when I'm a fully formed adult, you'd think, but I'm come back to school, to graduate study in history, and I'm assigned to read E. Franklin Frazier's very important, very influential book called Black Bourgeoisie. And Franklin, by the time he writes that book, is a distinguished, very distinguished sociologist of the black experience. And he now aims his social scientific lens at the talented 10th, really in an indictment. He brands folks like my grandparents as status-seeking, superficial, disloyal to Black Americans as a whole, more preoccupied with money and the trappings of bourgeois life than they are with racial progress or civil rights. And that might be enough to set me back, but Frazier and my grandfather were, if not friends, they were allies. They had known each other as young men in Atlanta in the 1920s. And by the 1940s, they are both being subjected to what will become the Cold War, McCarthy era scrutiny of Black leaders who are variously being accused of being subversive. So what a complex scene. These men who are bound together in some sense by the politics of the day and the pernicious surveillance and suppression of Black Americans in the 40s and the 50s, but who between them have a different set of ideas about something like a place like Bennett College, a man like my grandfather who not only could pass for white on a given day, but whom Frazier suspects enjoys a certain kind of privilege that flows from that. That was hard, and it's still hard for me to sit with, and important for someone like me to sit with, I think, because Frazier's book is one part polemic, but it is another part sound social scientific style truth about the ways in which colorism has functioned importantly in and within the communities of Black Americans, even among allies and activists like my grandfather and Frazier.
In our last 20 seconds, is it getting better? I mean, is the next generation, you know, more open, more accommodating, just better at it?
I'll let you know. I mean, this book is giving me a chance to talk to more young people than on this question than I ever have. And the good news, I think, is that they have a vocabulary, they have a set of questions, and they're a little skeptical of people like me who are rooted in some old and threadbare ideas about race and identity, and I guess I welcome that.
Well, the threadbare ideas, I don't know, they may be threadbare, but they were fascinating to me. Dr. Martha S. Jones, the new book is called The Trouble of Color, an American Family Memoir. Many thanks. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
This has been an archive edition of Midday. Thanks for listening on the radio or online. Thanks also for subscribing to our podcast, which you can find on the WYPR app or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Tom Hall. So glad you could be with us. Have a great day.